From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We have a live concert on today's Fresh Air featuring jazz pianist Jay McShann. The Kansas City big band he founded in the 1930s gave Charlie Parker his start. Now McShann is one of the last great musicians from that Kansas City era. Also today, I talk with writer Richard Ford. His new book is a collection of short stories titled Rock Springs. It comes on the heels of his critically acclaimed novel, The Sports Writer. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Bruce Springsteen album, Tunnel of Love. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bestseller, the new thriller starring James Woods and Brian Dennehy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Each month on Fresh Air, we bring you a live concert from our studio. Today we have a very special concert with Jay McShann, the last of the great Kansas City pianists, now that Count Basie, Mary Lou Williams, and Pete Johnson are gone. McShann is seated at the piano, ready to play some music and tell us a little about his life. Jay McShann grew up in Oklahoma and came to Kansas City in 1937 when it was the capital for boogie-woogie, blues, and swing. In Kansas City, he assembled his now legendary big band. Some of his sidemen included bassist Gene Ramey, drummer Gus Johnson, tenor saxophonist Paul Quinchette, and blues shouters Joe Turner and Walter Brown. But McShann's most remarkable find was Charlie Parker, who got his start in the band and made his recording debut with McShann. McShann's big band split up during World War II when he and most of the musicians were drafted. The jazz scene changed after the war, and listeners lost track of McShann. The 70s brought a resurgence of interest in the Kansas City style and in Jay McShann, and he's since recorded many solo and small group records and was the focus of the documentary film The Last of the Blue Devils. Now in his 70s, McShann continues to perform across Europe and America and records now on Sackville Records. Jay McShann, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Terry, and it's a pleasure to be here.
If I may, can I make a request for the opening? Could you open with one of the songs that you wrote and that is named after you, Hootie Blues?
Be glad to. Me. Hello, little gal, don't you remember me? Now the time ain't been so long, but I had a little break, you see. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, I'm doing all right. Well, I found a little Cupid doll. Well, she lives three flights out, and she sends me with a smile. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Well, she calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. She calls me her lover, yes, and a beggar too. Well, Yeah, she calls me her lover. Yes, and a beggar too. Now ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Ain't you sorry, little girl, that my new little girl ain't you. Ain't you.
That sounds absolutely terrific. My guest is Jay McShann at the piano. Can we go back to around the period when that tune was written, back to the 1930s when you came to Kansas City and started putting your big band together? Kansas City was a real mecca for jazz then. What were your first impressions when you got there?
Well, my first impressions was I was excited and seeing all this happening and guys like Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, playing all the boogie-woogie, Joe Turner singing blues right off the top of his head, you know, he'd make up words as he'd go along. And all these musicians are playing all this swing music, you know, and musicians from north, east, south, and west, and it was excitable. It was exciting.
How did you decide to put together a big band? How did you go about starting to do that?
Well, what happened, we had a small group at first, I imagine about four, five, sometimes six pieces. And then we got a job to play for Walkathon, and that required about 12, 13-piece band, big band. And so we took this job, and so quite naturally we had to have a big band. And the Walkathon lasted about 4 months. And so during the 4 months, that's how we got our book together and then got the band together so fast.
What would you do to go recruit musicians? Where would you go to hear who the best musicians were?
Well, the way I did, I even went up to Omaha. And at that time, Nat Towles had one of the finest bands in the country. And I went up to listen to some of his musicians play. And when I left Omaha, I left there with about four of them.
Was that considered bad form to steal musicians from somebody else's band?
Well, no, it's not bad form as long as, you know, if they owe the band leader, then you give them the money to pay the band leader and bring them on. Really, it's nice, much nicer for them to give a notice, you know, but, you know, guys do things like that.
Probably the greatest discovery you made was finding Charlie Parker and getting him into your band. How did you decide to recruit him?
Well, I just happened to be passing through the streets one night, and they piped all the music out in Kansas City, and I heard this particular sound, and so I went in to see who it was, and then so we met and we talked, and he told me he'd been out of town because I thought I hadn't been in Kansas City very long, and I thought I'd met most of the musicians. So he said he'd been down in the Ozarks with George Lee's band, and it's hard to get musicians to go down there because it's so dead, you know, and like cats like to be around where the happenings is, you know. And so he said he wanted to do a little woodshedding, so he went down there with George's band.
And then you got him in your band. Was Jumpin' Blues, I think. Did you co-write that with him, Jumpin' the Blues?
Yes, we did.
Could you play it for us?
Okay.
This is a song that my guest Jay McShann co-wrote with Charlie Parker. Thank you. That's Jump in the Blues, played by my guest, Jay McShann. Let's talk some more about the big band for a little while. It's such a big responsibility to hold a band together and to make sure all the players show up on time and that they're there when you're ready to travel and everything. Did you enjoy that part of it?
Well, that was quite a responsibility. But we made it easier, I guess, because, all the guys are young and crazy. Since everybody was crazy, you did a lot of crazy delegating, you know. And like some guys, Gene Ramey, he would always look out for a couple, three of the guys. And I could count on Bob Maybain keeping a couple, three guys straight, you know. And I liked that, and it was no problem.
Around during the war, you were drafted, right?
That's true.
A lot of guys in the band were drafted. Did you realize that was going to be the end of the band?
Well, no, I didn't have any idea that would be the end of the band because at the time we were booked about a couple of years ahead and we were really stretched out. But they had been trying to catch up with me and we was on the road traveling. They couldn't find me, so we played a one-night stand. So then they took me right on to Leavenworth after that, doing intermission.
Huh. What happened after the war when your big band had split up? What did you decide to do? Where did you go?
Well, after the war, most of the dance halls were made into
clubs.
Most of the dance halls, were made where they throw these balls.
Bowling alleys.
Bowling alleys. Yeah, I couldn't even think of it. And then it was quite expensive to move a big band then.
Yeah.
But it had gotten quite expensive. And then people were buying combos, smaller groups, four or five and six piece groups.
So where did you go? Did you go back to Kansas City?
Yes, I went back to Kansas City. And then I tried the big band again, but it wasn't going to work. It didn't work.
Because of financial reasons?
That's right. Yeah, financial reasons were just too outlandish.
I think a lot of people lost track of where you were when you went to Kansas City. Did that bother you?
No, it didn't. You see, because my kids at that time, they were getting around school age. And I knew I had to pick out some place for them to go to school. And so I decided to go back to Kansas City.
It's difficult to have a family when you're on the road all the time.
Yes, it is. And so I came off the road, but I worked around Kansas City, maybe within the radius of 600-700 miles, and in Kansas City, continued to play, but I didn't get out and stay out on the road, until after they finished high school.
So what kind of places were you playing when you returned?
Oh, it was nightclubs and, nightclubs and so forth.
Playing some of the standards that you had played with the band.
Say what?
Playing the same kinds of songs you play with the band, but with
primarily the same songs, but with smaller groups, sometimes we'd have a trio, sometimes maybe we'd have a quartet, whatever the gig called for. We had to kind of, go lean with the gig, whatever was happening.
My guest is the great Kansas City pianist, Jay McShann, and we're going to take a short break, then he's going to play some more, we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Pianist Jay McShann is my guest, and he led a now legendary big band in the 1930s and early 40s and has since been living in Kansas City. In the last dozen years or so, he's recorded many solo and small group albums. He now records on the Sackville record label, and he's continuing to tour Europe and America to perform. Jay McShann, can I ask you to play something else for us? How about a standard? This isn't the kind of thing you used to play back in the old days.
Okay. grow too old to dream. I'll have you to remember, and when I grow too old to dream, your love will be in my heart. So kiss me, oh, kiss me, my sweet. And now let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, well, your love will be in my heart. Kiss me, oh, kiss me, my sweet. And now, oh, let us part. And when I grow too old to dream, your love will be in my heart. Well, your love will be in my heart. When your love will be in my heart.
A beautiful version of that. You didn't really sing too much, at least not on your records, when you had your big band, and the singers were Walter Brown, Big Joe Turner, Al Hibbler sometimes sang with you. How come you never got to sing yourself very much? Or maybe you did in concerts, which I wasn't around for.
No, I didn't. I didn't do any singing. In fact, I didn't do any singing at all. And I always felt that, you know, with the big band, you always... You wanted good singers.
Wait a minute. You were implying that you were not a good singer.
But then after the war, you know, then I couldn't afford the good singers, and so I had to, you know, people would come up and ask for tunes, and they said, well, we want somebody to sing it, and so then I had to sing it, you know. So that's why I started.
So you don't think of yourself as a singer?
No.
Well, you don't have the kind of really big shouter type voice. But I really do love your voice very much. Were you self-conscious at first when you started to sing?
Well, I guess it does kind of work on you to a certain extent, because you don't want to, I didn't want to do it, you know. But then after you started doing it, you know, well, then it just comes in just like you're playing, you know.
Now, another thing that's changed, in your band you mostly did blues and boogie-woogies, and now you're doing more standards, like what you just played. Is that something you decided to do yourself, or was that also like what you were saying, people have their requests and then you have to fill them?
Well, no, a lot of people probably never knew this, you see. When we first organized the band, see, the band was playing stuff like Yardbird Suite and all that kind of stuff, I mean, with the big band.
Mm-hmm.
And we had never... in fact, we probably was lucky if we had one or two blues tunes in the repertoire. And so one night, we got a chance to record. And I came by a club one night, and I heard Walter Brown singing, and I had, I had a couple of beers, and it sounded pretty good to me. So I walked over to him and told him, I says, look, I says, we might record maybe in about a couple of weeks or a week or so. I said, 10 days, I says, I just might take you along, and if I can get you on the session, I'll use you. So he said, okay. So what we did, we put the Hootie Blues together, and we did put Confessing the Blues together, and that gave us two tunes for him. And so we went on down to record, and everything that we had in mind, see, which was for the band, they didn't want. So the guy says, well, can you play a boogie-woogie? He says, yes, we played Vine Street Boogie.
He said, can you play a blues? Yes, we played a blues, played Hootie Blues. And he was smiling. He was very happy. He said, do me one more blues, then I'll take that other tune, that band tune called Swingmatism. So we did Confessing the Blues, and the blues turned out to be the big hits. And so quite naturally, when they come out on record, everybody figured it was strictly a blues band.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So you had wanted all along to do more diverse
things.
That's
what we did all along.
And, except for in the recording studio.
Yes.
Oh. Now, you went back to Kansas City after the war, and you were playing in clubs there. Were there a lot of Kansas City musicians who you had known before you started traveling with your band who were still in Kansas City and never played outside of it, never toured with a band?
Well, that's true. Yes, it was a lot of cats because then a lot of guys, you know, were around Kansas City. They were married, some of them, and their wives didn't want that stuff, you know. And then with some some guys, they just did not like the road. And then there was guys that did like the road, you know.
Were you sorry to be off the road at all? Did you miss it when you decided to stay home in Kansas City?
Well, not necessarily. I wouldn't say that I missed it because I had a lot of fun with the kids coming up, you know. And that was one part I didn't want to miss. I want to see them grow up, you know, and have fun with them, in which we had a lot of fun together.
Was there usually a big homecoming kind of party if someone like Mary Lou Williams or Count Basie came back to Kansas City to play?
Well, you know, any time Basie came to Kansas City, Mary Lou Williams, or any of those guys that have been around Kansas City, when they come back, it was a big get-together, you know. Yes.
Can I ask you how you started to play piano, how you first started to learn the instrument?
Well, you know, when you're in school, your parent, the band, the guy got the band at school, you know, he wants you to get an instrument and play an instrument, you know. And my folks was too poor to buy me an instrument. And I wanted to either play trumpet or sax or clarinet. But they didn't have the money, and so consequently I couldn't get no horn to play. So we had a beat up Kimball piano there, so I just started fooling around on the piano.
And then you left home when you were pretty young to try to make it?
Yes. I guess I left home around 16, something like that.
Did you play in a lot of other people's bands before you got your own?
Yes,
together?
I played with Al Denny, who was one of the first big bands I'd ever played with in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and also played with the Gray Brothers. They had a small group, and that was the beginning.
You know, I have a reissue of your big band album. It was a reissue of singles initially. It's a Decca reissue of the singles that your big band originally recorded. The liner notes were written by Frank Driggs. This came out in the late 60s, and he said, Jay McShann is still playing somewheres in the Midwest. And I thought, well, had people really lost track of you that much then? Because everybody just rediscovered you again in the 70s. What was that like to again become the center of attention in the 70s when people started making movies about you and having you record?
Well, I don't know. It's just, I guess that's just the way it happened, you know. Because during the time when the kids, as I said, were in school, I didn't do that much traveling. So after they came out of high school, then I started moving about, and then started going to Europe and a lot of places, and places I hadn't been, you know. In fact, traveling all over the world.
Were you surprised, though, to see the kind of attention that you were getting?
Well, yes, you know, it surprises you. A lot of different things surprises, you know what I mean? But surprise is always good for you.
I think we can all hear your piano style a lot more now, too. Now that you're playing in small groups and playing solo, you can hear a pianist in a way that you can't when they're in a big band.
Well, you know, when I had a big band, I always felt like that we had all those horns up there, and I always wanted everybody to work. You know, I wanted to hear everybody working because it used to bug me to see maybe three-fourths of the guys standing up holding their horns. You know, that always, you know, and I always like to see them busy all the time, ensemble or something going all the time, you know, with the big band. And so they always told me, though, I should have taken more solos, but I always liked that ensemble.
I just one last thing. You know, I've been calling you the last of the great Kansas City pianists, and it's it must be something you think about a lot to be a survivor like that.
Well, I enjoyed playing music, and it's always good to be the survivor.
Well, you bet. It's really been very exciting to hear you play today. I've wanted to be able to hear you in person for many years. So thank you so much for coming and for giving all of our listeners such a special opportunity to hear your music. Thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Being here. My guest has been Kansas City pianist Jay McShann, who led a legendary big band in the 30s and 40s, then went back to Kansas City and is now touring the States and touring America, performing and also recording on the Sackville record label. And I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And on our next show, I'll speak with playwright Albert Inarrado. He had a long-running Broadway hit with his play Gemini. His other plays include The Transfiguration of Ben O'Blimpie and Coming of Age in Soho, so I hope you can join us. Jay McShann, can you play us out? Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with novelist Richard Ford, author of The Sports Writer, and a new collection of short stories titled Rock Springs. Like one of his characters, Ford distrusts grand themes in literature. He writes about the changing details of daily life. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from another observer of the human condition, Bruce Springsteen. The album's titled Tunnel of Love. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bestseller, starring James Woods and Brian Dennehy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Bruce Springsteen's new album, Tunnel of Love, arrived in record stores this week. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. This is the title track, which includes screams recorded on a roller coaster in Point Pleasant Beach, New Jersey.
sitting on a little stool, takes the money from my hand while his eyes take a walk all over you. Hands me two tickets, smiles and whispers good luck. Well, cuddle up, angel, cuddle up, my little dove. Well, ride down, baby, into this tunnel of love.
On his new album, Tunnel of Love, Bruce Springsteen has left behind the big, booming rock sound of Born in the USA. He's stripped down his music for a dozen new love songs. There was much ado in the gossip columns when Springsteen married model Julianne Phillips 2 years ago, and now Springsteen makes much of it too. He's written Thanks Julie on the album liner notes and has composed a series of tunes about marriage, fidelity, commitment, and romance. This represents a significant shift in the sensibility of the man who used to yell, "Tramps like us, baby, we were born to run." Now it seems they were born to get hitched. Some of these new songs, as a result, are pretty drippy. Most of them, thankfully, are not.
Bobby said he'd pull out, Bobby stayed in. Janet had a baby, wasn't Lanny Sam. They were set to marry on a summer day.
That's Spare Parts, probably the best song on Tunnel of Love. Spare Parts is blunt, passionate, and precise, Raymond Carver speaking through the voice of Muddy Waters. Throughout this record, Springsteen's usual complement of lower middle class down-and-outers are made idealized, almost mythic. Their love is so strong that it either saves their lives or destroys them. Sometimes this sort of thing becomes terribly melodramatic and sentimental, as on the tiresome When You're Alone.
Times were tough, love was not enough. So you said, "Sorry, Johnny, I'm gone, gone, gone." You said my act was funny, but we both knew what was missing, honey. So you lit out on your own. Now that pretty form that you've got, baby, we'll make sure you get along. But you're gonna find out someday, honey. When you're alone, you're alone. When you're alone, you're alone. When you're alone, you're alone. When you're alone, you ain't nothing but alone.
Now, let me get this straight, Bruce. When you're alone, you're alone. I see. A song like this would, on any other record by a major star, sound suspiciously like stale filler, but Springsteen can't be accused of that. He hasn't rushed Tunnel of Love into the record stores to make a fast buck. It's been 4 years since Born in the USA. And he deserves credit for refusing to build Tunnel of Love into an overblown media event the way Michael Jackson did with Bad last month. There's a sense in which the small scale of these songs is ingratiating. By refusing to cook up another mass culture political statement, he's avoided becoming a pontificating bore.
If Tunnel of Love has more than its share of moony bellowing, it also has some lovely moments, times when Springsteen proves once again his command of the strict simplicity of the best rock songwriting.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Well, it's Saturday night. You're all dressed up in blue. I've been watching you for a while. Maybe you've been watching me too. So somebody ran out, left somebody's heart in a mess. Well, if you're looking for love, honey, I'm tougher than the rest. Some girls, they want a handsome dame, some good looking Joe. On their arms, some girls like...
This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Richard Ford, whose 1986 novel The Sports Writer was highly praised by critics. His new book, Rock Springs, is a collection of short stories, most of which are set in Montana, where Ford now lives. In reviewing Rock Springs for the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani wrote, "In Rock Springs, things have a way of stupidly, abruptly going wrong, changing in a single unwatched moment the course of an entire life, and dividing all time irrevocably into a now and a then." This volume should confirm Ford's emergence as one of the most compelling and eloquent storytellers of his generation, unquote. I began my interview with Richard Ford by asking him to read from the title story, Rock Springs.
In this story, a man has stolen a car and run off with his girlfriend and his own daughter, heading for Florida. And at some point in that journey, everything kind of falls apart, and his girlfriend leaves him. He's left with his daughter, at night, alone, in a Ramada Inn, wondering what in the world to do next. And this is the last paragraph of that story. I walked over to a car, a Pontiac with Ohio tags, one of the ones with bundles and suitcases strapped to the top and a lot more in the trunk by the way it was riding. I looked inside the driver's window. There were maps and paperback books and sunglasses and the little plastic holders for cans that hang on the window wells. And in the back, there were kids' toys and some pillows and a cat box with a cat sitting in it, staring up at me like I was the face of the moon. It all looked familiar to me, the very same things I would have in my car if I had a car. Nothing seemed surprising, nothing different. Though I had a funny sensation at that moment and turned and looked up at the windows along the back of the motel. All were dark except two, mine and another one. And I wondered, because it seemed funny, what would you think a man was doing if you saw him in the middle of the night looking in the windows of cars in the parking lot of a Ramada Inn? Would you think he was trying to get his head cleared? Would you think he was trying to get ready for a day when trouble would come down on him? Would you think his girlfriend was leaving him? Would you think he had a daughter? Would you think he was anybody like you?
Do you think of that as your job as a writer, in a way, making readers think about characters in ways they otherwise wouldn't have?
Well, it's funny. That might be the way it comes out. Mostly what I think of my job is, and mostly what I think about my job is, that it's a privilege. I think about the opportunity to write about the most important things that I know about. I do think that if the stories succeed, I point my readers to people's lives, lives that may be different from theirs, but which are at the same time like theirs.
In your stories, there are frequently seemingly trivial actions that take place or small coincidences that end up causing some kind of irrevocable change in someone's life. Yeah. Have things like that happened to you? Have small things disrupted your life in an irrevocable way or in a bad way that really changed your life?
Well, large things have happened in seemingly irrevocable ways. I mean, but I don't think that in my life they're any different from the things that happen in everybody's life. You know, deaths of loved ones, illnesses. When I was a kid, I had hepatitis, and I remember the doctor coming into my room one day when I'd been in bed about 6 weeks and saying, "Well, it's possible that you won't die." And I thought to myself, "Die?" I said, "I'm just 20 years old." And he said it in such an offhand way that I don't think I've ever quite recovered from the kind of small business way he came into the room and remarked that I probably wasn't going to die of this. And beyond that, I think that everybody lives his life day to day through small events. We don't have very many great epiphanies on a day-to-day level.
I'm going to quote you again. This is a quote from The Sports Writer, your novel. And the main character says, "If there's anything that sports writing teaches you, it is that there are no transcendent themes in life. The other view is a lie of literature and the liberal arts." Do you distrust novels or literature with transcendent themes and tidy beginnings and endings?
Well,
are you trying to do something different in your literature?
Well, that in some ways owes to a question you asked before about observing the world in its small moments and its small details. I really think that that's where everybody lives, and you can distort that fact. And I don't know. In fact, I don't think it is really writers who do that so much. It's people who write about writing who discover what themes are there and discover what is transcendent about a piece of literature or a piece of writing. I think in a way that what Frank was talking about, if I can speak about Frank as if he existed, which in fact he's a character in literature and doesn't entirely exist, he was just talking about the ways in which conventional wisdom can be a detriment to our understanding the day-to-day goings-on in our life. We all know people, I think, you and I, anybody, know people who sort of go through their lived life as if it were a syllabus topic. And I think that I believe myself that that's not a very expert way to go through your life, because it causes you to miss the minutiae, it causes you to miss the conflicting details, which make life at once more interesting and more complicated.
The way I understand it, when you were growing up, your father was a traveling salesman.
Yes.
And your mother's family owned hotels or motels?
They were in the hotel business in Little Rock, and before that in Oklahoma City.
So did you travel a lot?
I did indeed. I traveled with my father through in the South, in Louisiana and Arkansas and Mississippi and Alabama. So I was kind of really on the run from the time I was about 8, and in some ways I've been on the run ever since.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, my wife and I, we've just kind of stayed on the move for one reason or other, trying to find some place that we thought was interesting, trying to find some place we liked better. I think that may be coming to an end. We just bought a house in Montana, which we like a lot, and we also have a lot of affection for Mississippi, where I'm from. So I think it may be that as close as we get to ever settling down, we'll be living part of the year in the mountains up here and part of the year back in the Delta in Mississippi.
So you've really stayed in a lot of hotels in your time.
Yes, I haven't stayed in enough of them as far as I'm concerned.
You like them?
Yes, I like them a lot.
There's a great line that I want to read in Rock Springs, the title story of your new collection. And it's about hotels. And it's, the main character is driving a stolen car. So he's basically hiding out from the police. And he's going to a hotel. And he says, I knew that it was in the little nowhere places that the police look for you and find you. People I'd known were always being arrested in cheap hotels and tourist courts with names you'd never heard of before, never in Holiday Inns or travel lodges. What made you think about that? You probably stayed in a lot of those little places that had unrecognizable names.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting to me. It may not be interesting to anybody else. I mean, I've seen a lot of people be arrested in hotels. The criminal instinct in some ways is a defeatable instinct, because the law probably has been thinking about where people hide out a lot longer than the individual fellow is who's on the outside of the law.
Most of your characters believe in luck, and they're always watching signs to see if if the signs indicate that their luck is going to change. Yeah. And I wonder if you're superstitious when a new book comes out.
No, I'm really not superstitious about that or about anything. I mean, I'm not going to walk under a ladder, frankly, because there's just no use inviting bad luck. But I do believe when I guess I talk about luck that what I guess I'm getting at is that, back to that old line, bad things can happen to you, and then that's bad luck. And then if something less than bad happens to you, well, that's good luck. When something really good happens to you, that's wonderful luck. But I'm not superstitious when books come out, and I'll tell you why. Because with the four books that I've written in my life over these 15 or so years, I've done my best at every one of them. And at that point, I can't do anything else. And I just give it up to the world at that point. And so to hope for it or to be superstitious about its you know, fate in the world seems to just be a waste of my interest, a waste of my time. I've done my best. Here it is. What happens to it will be what happens to it.
Well, I really enjoy your writing, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very kind to say so, and it's nice to talk to you.
Richard Ford's new collection of short stories, Rock Springs, is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up on All Things Considered tonight?
Well, tonight we'll have a report on the visit of a top Soviet official, the man Gorbachev has chosen to revitalize the Soviet agriculture. He toured an American supermarket, and his critique, he loves the packaging, but he thinks that Russian bread is still better. Brooklyn after the Dodgers tonight. 30 years after the Dodgers decided to pick up and head for Los Angeles, we take a look at the combination of cultural and transportation factors that led to that decision. Also, drunken bears in Montana. There's a little town called Essex where bears have figured out that fermented corn is a natural bar.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new thriller bestseller. It stars Brian Dennehy and James Woods. They play a cop and a killer who have an unusual relationship.
Bestseller has gotten terrible reviews, and I guess I can understand why. It's a pretty scummy shoot-'em-up, and its tawdry B-movie style is not for the high-minded. To like Bestseller, which I do, you have to get into the spirit of the thing. And to do that, you have to understand that at bottom, it's a love story. Or rather a seduction story, like Something Wild or Bringing Up Baby. In those movies, boy meets girl. Boy flees girl because he's afraid of the wild and crazy world she's beckoning him into. And boy finally gives in and falls for girl, following her into the exciting darkness she inhabits. Bestseller works almost the same way, except, well, the boy is a tough cop played by blubbery Brian Dennehy, and the dangerous temptress is a slimy hitman played by slimy James Woods. Let me explain. The cop Dennehy plays is also a best-selling author who's reached a sort of crossroads. He's getting too old to keep chasing criminals, and he's also got a mean case of writer's block. Woods, meanwhile, is a fan of his who wants to get even with the zillionaire businessman for whom he's been offing inconvenient auditors and SEC types. He wants to show Dennehy where the bodies are buried and have Dennehy write a best-selling exposé of the nefarious tycoon. The plot, needless to say, isn't exactly a model of plausibility, and the filmmakers can't quite figure out how to keep it going, as witness this little diversionary tactic.
I want to meet your family, Cleve.
Totally out of the question.
Yeah, I bet your mom and dad still live in the house where you were born. Am I right, Cleve, huh? Little farm someplace? Sure. White picket fence around? Smell of leaves burning in the fall? Well, we're going to make that place famous, Cleve. A regular landmark. place where a vicious, amoral killer was spawned and set loose on the world. Hmm? We're going to Oregon, Cleve. We're going to go home.
But don't see bestseller for the plot. This is not the action movie it seems. At heart, it's a duet for character actors. And Dennehy and Woods do a great job of digging down into their characters' eerie psychological states. Director John Flynn and screenwriter Larry Cohen have concocted some of the oddest tough guy scenes in memory, including one in which Woods half climbs into Dennehy's bed one night, and the cop and the hitman proceed to wave their guns at one another in a kind of outré hard-boiled flirtation. It's the damnedest case of I'll show you mine if you show me yours. None of this is at all overt. But then the best stuff in a lot of action movies is what you read between the lines. Dennehy plays his role with a kind of Spencer Tracy gruffness, snarling at Woods and yet unable to take his eyes off him. And Woods, who has shown himself a past master at playing oily creeps, outdoes himself. He oozes through the movie on a cushion of sleaze and yet gives his performance all kinds of levels and shades. He can be touching, arrogant, sensitive, childlike, and brutal. Bestseller is nutty, but it isn't campy or spoofy or unintentionally funny. It has the courage of its weird convictions. It's truly ardent. Woods may be the world's most efficient killer in this movie, but when he gazes at Dennehy and lowers his sultry lashes just a centimeter, that look feels completely genuine, and it's the look of love.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with performance artist Meredith Monk. Her wordless songs evoke the full range of human emotion. Brazilian composer and guitarist Orlando Haddad will perform two songs popularized in Brazilian films, and Ken Tucker will review the home video release of The Night of the Hunter, the 1955 classic starring Robert Mitchum as a psychopathic Appalachian preacher and Shelley Winters as a gullible widow. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.